Splendid Table is brought to you by all the chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. And if you like it, please share it. Leave us a review where you found it. It really helps us out. You can also find recipes and videos and information on just about everything else you hear today on our website, splendidtable.org. But right now, let's get to this week's show. It's The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. On our show, we talk a lot about what we eat and how and even why, but we don't often think about where we eat. When we start asking ourselves why that matters, we think about things like why we rarely see restaurants where the guests are a mix of different races, or how formal dining rooms are becoming a thing of the past, and some of them actually have a pretty crazy past. But let's start with this first, the unique power in street food. For years, I lived in a neighborhood in Queens, New York, where within a 10-minute walk, you could eat the food of 20 different countries and a lot of the best street food in town. And you know, there's something so profound about eating in the street. It makes you feel anonymous and maybe weirdly intimate. You can eat and be on your way, or you can end up finding out the most personal details of the person next to you, scarfing down tacos. So for years, I'd come home from work and appreciate the crowds at my favorite arepa cart, or the Tibetan dumpling truck, or the chili lime fruit stands. But whenever I was out a little bit later, there was always one truck that caught my eye that seemed different. It was a little pickup truck with no menu or prices, just a bunch of coolers in the back and a man dishing out food to the people gathered around. Well, I learned years later, that man's name is Jorge Munoz, and he's a bus driver. He's been feeding hungry people on that corner out of his own pocket every night for more than 12 years. Von Diaz has his story.
It's a tough time to be an immigrant in the U.S., especially if you're undocumented. The constant threat of immigration policy changes proposed by the new administration is creating a culture of fear in every corner of the nation. In some places, immigrants are going into hiding, even when they're in serious need of basic resources. On a bustling intersection in Woodside, Queens, one of the most diverse neighborhoods in one of the most diverse cities in the world, day laborers, many of them immigrants, linger, waiting for work opportunities. And one man is there each night to make sure that, if nothing else, they get a hot meal.
Regular person, nothing special. I just love to help someone, love to do something for somebody that they don't know, and bring something he need and say, we see you tomorrow. I will have something else for tomorrow.
That's Jorge Munoz Zapata, known locally as the Angel of Queens, or more simply by the folks he feeds as Colombia. As someone who cooks regularly, I know the distinct pleasure of preparing and serving a meal for my friends and loved ones. The feeling of watching people you care about enjoying food you've lovingly prepared is addictive. But I've never seen anything like Jorge's generosity and commitment to feeding a community of strangers. So I visited him in his modest kitchen, where on a Sunday night, like every other night of the week, he's packing up food for the workers.
In the beginning, the thing that moved me was stop throwing good food in the garbage. If someone somewhere need a plate of meal, why just cook here and then bring it to them? Be the bridge between the food and the people who need it.
Jorge is 53 years old and lives with his elderly mother and sister. Soon after he started his one-man soup kitchen in 2004, he learned that many of those who stood in line for a meal were Latino immigrants who'd spent the day looking for work and couldn't find any. For many of those workers, the meal he provided was all they'd had to eat that day, an experience he can really relate to.
My mom came back in the 1980s, and then my sister and me in 1981. My mom, she says, we got no future in Colombia. My dad died in 1974, so she decided to came to this country. That's the way we started here.
Soon after he arrived, a fellow Colombian gave him a leg up and his first job, and he's never forgotten him. Partly in his honor, he started serving food to the needy 13 years ago. But he says he's recently noticed a shift in the folks who are coming to get food.
They're a little bit afraid because when I used to get there around 10 o'clock, there are already like 60 guys lined up. Now, when I get there at 10, there's only like 12, 15, and then as soon as they're looking around, there is no dangers around, they just line up.
When did you start to see people act that way?
I would say back in November when the new president saying things about immigrants.
Jorge doesn't work for an organization. He does this completely on his own and pays for much of the food he serves. It's taken a toll on his finances.
How much do you estimate you pay out of pocket for this every week?
Not me, my sister. She's the one who's running right now because I ran out the money about a year ago. All my savings gone. I would say like between $450 and $500 a week. That includes everything, including containers, fork, the cup to drink, the gas for the truck, the cooking gas. It's everything, everything.
And how does your family feel about investing money in this?
We start together. We just keep doing it together. We enjoy. Because what you get back is nice. It's nothing about money, nothing about glamour or famous or whatever. It's something that you see in the people. And you see that smile, that's okay, I got my pay now. I bring back that smile. And I share with my family or the volunteers.
Jorge cooks traditional Colombian, arguably pan-Latino fare.
Rice and chicken on top.
That's pollo guisado, or stewed chicken. And I had to try some.
Son cadera, ¿verdad?
Sí, es de chicken todo, thigh? Es de todo, es de todo.
Mm-hmm. Oye, eso está bien rico. Eso está bien rico.
Lo cocino y luego lo...
I have to admit, I felt guilty eating even a bite of this food, which might be the only meal a person has in their entire day. But it helped me understand something special about Jorge. He thinks a lot about what he's serving. It's important to him that these workers and folks struggling with homelessness enjoy what they're eating.
Yeah, because we came from a Spanish country. We like the seasoning. We like cumin. We got garlic.
He wants them to eat well and eat things that remind them of home. And I can tell you, I would eat his pollo guisado every day if I could. Jorge is short-staffed on the night that I visit him. His mother is in bed with a cold, and his sister just traveled back to Colombia to visit family. But he also has a core group of nightly volunteers, among them Giovanni Torres and Melissa Marin, two Colombian immigrants in their early 20s.
I helped out volunteering to pick up donations from two different Colombian bakeries, any empanadas, any food that they have over from throughout the day.
Well, for me, it was because, I mean, in Colombia, my mom always brought me to places to do things like that since I was little. And when I saw him doing that, it made me feel like I was home with my mom and helping those that are in need.
And now that we've packed everything up in boxes and coolers, the real work begins.
Right now, it's 8:20 p.m. And I stop before, get to the corner, pick up a donation, and then I'll be there like 9:45. 12, 15 guys line up already waiting for the food because they're immature. They have the meal.
The corner of 74th Street and Roosevelt Ave is on the edge of Jackson Heights in Queens. It's surrounded by all sorts of businesses, restaurants, cell phone stores, eyebrow shops, and bars and dance clubs. And even at 10 p.m. on a Sunday, the intersection is rowdy with heavy street traffic.
Right now, we're under the train on the 74th Broadway. We see them all around the walls with their hoodies on and stuff, and they're just trying to not be obvious. They're afraid. They feel like shadows.
By the time we arrive, even I'm exhausted. But not Jorge, who stands in the bed of his truck directing a symphony of volunteers who pass along plates of food and pour beverages into plastic cups. He recognizes the workers' faces and gently calls them out when they try to get back in line for seconds.
They were so happy because of their Mexican tamales and the oatmeal. They have a menu to choose, so they got few options to eat. They were happy.
And what are your hopes for the people that come through your line?
Me, they say, I hope they got a job tomorrow. I hope they don't have to wait until 10 o'clock p.m. to eat something.
I leave Jorge that night knowing he'll be up first thing in the morning, ready to do this all over again, rain or shine. Whatever the cost, it's his mission and his purpose. To know that these folks, much like him when he first arrived, have someone to count on every single day. An unlikely bit of home on a street corner in Queens.
Jorge Munoz is the founder of An Angel in Queens. Von Diaz's forthcoming book is about Puerto Rican food, and it's called Coconuts and Collards. Say you want to bake a pie. Aunt Edna always loves your pies. But how will you bring it to her? That is a real problem. Because we all know pies and cakes want to travel more than their delicate constitutions allow. Crust flake off, lattices break like so many hearts, and let's not even get started on how many square miles of cake frosting have been sacrificed to the let's eat this somewhere else gods. Well, our friends at America's Test Kitchen understand this poignant problem. Our managing producer, Sally Swift, talked to ATK's Lisa McManus on her test of the finest, most secure cake and pie carriers.
Hey, Lisa, really nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I was recently gifted a wine clutch, if you can imagine. It's a little purse with handles. It's very fashionable, gold and black, insulated, and it fits exactly one bottle of wine.
Perfect.
So you're walking around carrying this little wine bottle. But it got me thinking about all of the stuff that is being made to carry things, to make food portable. And with picnic season upon us, I am wondering what you have found in the whole cake and pie carrier area.
Well, there's the, you know, old standby of trying to sit on your way to a party with a pie in your lap.
That
does not always work, especially around New England where the roads are bumpy. So we actually looked at both cake and pie carriers, 9 different products, some that were really designated as cake boxes and some as pie. And we really tried to find something that could bring a pie in perfect shape or a cake, because after you spend all that time baking from scratch and decorating the cake or frosting it perfectly, you don't want to ruin it in the last couple minutes before you get it in the door.
No kidding.
So we looked at a whole bunch of things. A lot of them are plastic. We did look at some fancier ones and ended up eliminating them because we really want you to be able to bring anything. You don't want to get to some dessert that you just can't fit in this thing after you bought it. We wanted something that had the flexibility to carry anything from an 8 to 10 inch pie, something that's a single crust, double crust, or with cakes, you know, so many cakes
right
now are tall and multi-layered. We didn't want you to be restricted by something that was a little too small.
So what should we be thinking about when we look at pie and cake carriers?
Well, one of the things that's important is the base. Does it have something a little bit grippy, or is that cake or pie going to be sliding around and smashing into the sides as soon as you move? Another is a handle, something to carry it with so that you can get mm-hmm. it and really have a good grip on it and maneuver it into the trunk of the car or the floor or wherever you're going to be. Some nice clips that really stay secure are important. And when it comes to storage, one of the things we found in the ones we liked the best, they were collapsible. So you didn't have to have this giant hat box-like thing that you had to keep somewhere.
So tell me what your winners were.
Well, actually, our winner for both cake and pie were made by the same company, Progressive. And the pie carrier is the PrepWorks Collapsible Pie and Deviled Egg Carrier. So it's not just for pies.
Wow, 2 for 1.
Yeah. And it's got a little insert in it that lets you either, you can carry one pie that's 8, 9, or 10 inches. It will pop up to a height of 6.5 inches. So we have this mile-high lemon meringue pie that's wonderful, and it's our tallest pie. And it's about almost 6 inches tall when you're done. And this fit. It was the only one that did. And it has this little insert that has the molded cups for deviled eggs, and you can carry up to 28 eggs. Or you can flip, if you have 2 flatter pies, say 2 custard pies, you can flip that insert over and carry it like a bunk bed for your pies, one on the bottom, one on the top.
Wow, that really sounds like a super smart design.
Yeah, and the cake one works similarly. It has space for cupcakes, so you can carry 2 dozen cupcakes. So it's kind of perfect.
And how did you test these, may I ask?
Well, we did what we usually do, which is we thought of all these different types of pies and cakes and we put them in and made sure they fit. But then we also walked around the block with them, We climbed in and out of cars. We drove up and down our New England bumpy roads. And we tried to see what emerged in good shape. With a cake carrier, we put the cupcake inserts in, and I filled it with potatoes. And I swung it around to make sure the handle wouldn't come off. And, you know, that would be the last thing you'd want to do is bake all this stuff and pick it up and boom, it's falling apart.
And really important to have something, I would imagine, that the top would come off. You wouldn't have to reach in to get it, right?
Yeah, because I mean,
that's the problem.
Some of the really cute ones that we were sort of interested in trying, there's a wooden one that's beautiful.
It's adorable. I've seen that one.
But if you have a, say, lemon meringue pie in there or a frosted cake, you have to reach down and get it. And that's not going to end well. I mean, So you might look cute coming in, but then you have this smashed up dessert. I don't know. So we just really were about being practical. We were about getting your beautiful baked goods there in one piece and the way you want them to look. Neither of these is very expensive. The cake carrier, the cake cupcake carrier is only $30, $29.95. Mm-hmm. The pie carrier is $19.50 last time I checked online. So it's a great bargain to make sure that your baked goods arrive the way they're supposed to.
And no one more powerful than someone who shows up with a cake to a picnic, I have to say.
Yeah, definitely. very popular.
Lisa, thank you.
You're welcome.
Lisa McManus is executive editor of Tests and Tastings for America's Test Kitchen. Find their list of the best pie and cake carriers and a recipe for their mile-high lemon meringue pie at splendidtable.org. Coming up, a surprising conversation with restaurateur Andy Shalal about the hidden codes in restaurants and what they mean to different races. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. Back in 1964, the Civil Rights Act desegregated restaurants. But over 50 years later, a restaurant critic, Todd Kleiman, took a random count in Washington, D.C. restaurants and found that in a span of 160 meals, only 8 times did he see more than 10 black people in the dining room. In 90 of his meals, there were only white people. So he set about asking why. He asked chefs, owners, managers, and no one would talk with him on record. Except for Andy Shalal. He's the owner of a half dozen restaurants called Busboys and Poets, whose purpose is to bring together guests of all races. Not just by saying, hey, sure, our door is open, but really working to find out how you make a space where everyone wants to come. Part of that, Andy says, is understanding that to welcome certain people, or to keep other people away, no one actually needs to say anything. Instead, he thinks every restaurant gives off invisible codes that tell us how welcome we really are. So we asked Andy to come help us decode what that means. Andy, great to talk with you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You know, I think it's probably a little bit charged to talk about restaurants as being segregated or integrated. But in reality, the fact is, when you look around most restaurant dining rooms, you really rarely see a real mix of different races. And you've decided that in your restaurants, a racially mixed crowd is exactly what you want. But it's not as simple as saying, hey, we're open, everyone's welcome, come on in, right? Because people tend to gravitate towards places that they feel comfortable in. And for whatever reason, not everyone finds the same places comfortable. So what are some of the choices that you've made to appeal to diners of different races?
Well, I mean, there's a big history, of course, in America about segregated restaurants. You know, I remember growing up here and seeing the footage on television of the Woolworth counters and the amount of violence that went into that. And I always wondered, like, what is it that makes people so angry about someone that's different from them dining next to them? That was always fascinating to me to see it in America. I come, of course, from Iraq. I'm a brown person. I don't identify as black or white. So for me, it was always this sort of strange puzzle that America is unable to come to grips with. And when I see restaurants, I see them as almost like a common ground that people can come to and be able to work through the racial differences by sitting together and breaking bread together.
So how do you make that happen?
So you have to look at what are the things that keep people away. And there are so many untold symbols out there, so many things that you experience as a diner when you go out to eat. And all of us know when we go out to eat, we have a good experience, a bad experience. Sometimes we can't really pinpoint why one experience was good and one wasn't. So if you are to dissect those pieces, you start looking at the staff, you start looking at the way you were greeted, you start looking at where you were seated, you start looking at the type of food you were served, who served you, how was it served. All these are little touch points that I think restaurants have that oftentimes have been ignored or left just to happen. And we really have a very strong intention about how those things happen. So for instance, if you have, let's say, a hostess at the door and you have an empty restaurant and it's a Saturday morning and we get busy for brunch, but let's say you just open the door and there's no one in the entire restaurant, but your whole staff is there. A black couple comes in. If you take them all the way to the back, see them in the corner, which happens to be the nicest table in the restaurant, the black couple might think, why are you putting me back here? Why are you putting me in the back corner? On the other hand, if you have a white couple, let's say, comes in, and you see them way in the back in the corner, and they're thinking they have a nice little private space all to themselves. The experiences are so different depending on what background we come from. So we train our staff to be much more aware of those things, not necessarily seat people in opposite places, but actually be aware of it. When you're seating people who may interpret a certain type of seating to be discriminatory, have a conversation with them and say, where would you like to sit? Or There's other instances. For instance, let's say you have a black hostess and you have a black couple walk in, and right behind them is a white couple. And the black hostess immediately goes to the black couple and she says, hey, how are y'all doing? Come on in. And she takes them and seats them. And then she goes back to the white couple and she says, two, right this way. Suddenly, the white couple feels like they're left out. And why aren't we part of the party? And that's, you know, and so we train with the idea that we are in a racial society, that race matters in America today, and that because of that, we don't pretend like it's invisible. We don't pretend like it's not there. We actually deal with it head on.
You mentioned in the article where you were quoted, in Todd Kleiman's article, that there were other issues too, like things that might be a little more, even more invisible, things like how your menu is written. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think when we moved into an area that was gentrifying, we wanted to make sure that people that have lived there are still going to stay and not feel like they're being pushed out, not only by, of course, the high cost of rents and cost of just living, but also by the type of places that are coming in and what kind of signals they send. And we wanted to make sure that we're not coming in with, arugula this and, foam this and, sauce that. But, I don't want to call something beurre blanc when it could be just a lemon butter sauce. You know, those types of things, I think, make a difference in how you connect with folks that may not be familiar with the more modern cuisine or the more, fancier names that we've given to dishes that may be really simple. We just make them fancy and charge a lot more for them. So we want to make sure that's usually how it works. We want to make sure that our menu is accessible to as many people as possible. So we are looking at not only racial diversity, we're looking for economic diversity. We're looking for people that are students. We're looking for people that are elderly that have lived here for a long time and are on limited income. So we try to really accommodate as many people as possible and create a menu that is very accessible. And you don't have to be embarrassed to pronounce something if you don't know how to say it exactly. You know what I mean? I think a lot of times when you have those types of menus, they tend to be intimidating and people don't go there because they don't want to be embarrassed in front of friends or in front of the waiter even.
Yeah. How successful do you think you are?
Well, I think we're pretty successful. I mean, we have been now in business at Busboys and Poets for over 12 years. And we have managed, despite all the changes that are happening all around us, the city is gentrifying by breakneck speed. despite all that, we still maintain one of the most diverse type of gathering places in the entire city. And we are fortunate in the fact that people still find us to be that safe space. And what really gives me hope and a sense of wanting to continue this is how many people tell us how much they really love this kind of atmosphere and why isn't it more prevalent. And that's really encouraging because deep down inside, I think people want to mix. They don't want to segregate. But because it's just more comfortable to segregate, they do. When they see how it could be, they are very thrilled and excited about it. And they're a lot more hopeful and really positive about it.
That's fascinating. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Andy.
Thank you.
Andy Shalal is the owner of Bus Boys and Poets. And if you'd like to read that article that inspired this conversation, it's called Coding and Decoding Dinner by Todd Kleiman at oxfordamerican.org. It's a really great read. It is that time. We get to talk to each other. Get to us any way you like. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, drop us an email, or pick up the phone, 1-800-537-5252. All right, so we have Dan on the line from Fairfax, Virginia. Hey, Dan, how are you?
Fine, thank you. I wanted to ask about what to do with cabbage and cauliflower outer leaves. Not the head, but the outer leaves.
Ah. I'm so glad you asked this, because I remember when I actually discovered that the outer leaves of cabbage were edible.
Yeah, it's just so wasteful not to cook them.
Yeah, and like if you especially get like the whole cauliflower with all the leaves, you really see how much of the leaf there really is. And the first time I actually tried cooking with them, I braised them down, and the thick stalks of the leaves, like, they got so tender and so beautiful. I don't even remember exactly what I cooked them in. I just remember so distinctly the stalks can get so soft and tender. So that's my first suggestion. You know, break those leaves off, chop them up. The stalk part especially, chop them up maybe a little bit more fine. And, you know, saute some garlic, some onions, some aromatics. Throw those guys in there, let them sweat a little bit, and then add some stock, some broth, you know, whatever you want, whatever liquid you want, really. And season it however you like to do it. If you like to, you know, braise greens in like a, you know, classic Southern style with maybe a ham hock or something like that. Or I love braising greens in dashi, in Japanese dashi, which is a stock of kombu, seaweed, and bonito flakes. I think that flavor is so good. It's so savory and beautiful. And honestly, like, just play with them. You might try roasting them. I love roasted broccoli stalks, so maybe the stalks of cabbage leaves, when they're really good and thick, will also cook to a nice sweetness when you've roasted them.
Would you also do that with, like, the stalk and the Brussels sprouts?
You know, I've never tried that, but why not?
Okay.
For that stalk, I might try peeling it, just because I'm thinking it's probably in the same, you know, it's obviously in the same family as broccoli, so that the outer side of the stalk might be pretty woody. And I would try peeling it and seeing if you don't get to like a sort of more translucent stalk, maybe a few swipes of the peeler in. You know what I mean? You get that fiber off.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for the call, Dan. So, you know, I was just talking about dashi and braising the greens in dashi, which is the thing I love to do. And if you don't know it, dashi is amazing. And it's like every chef's best friend these days, because it is this stock that can do all the things that a chicken stock can do. You know, you use it for braising, you can turn into soups, you can use it to add just a little bit of moisture and a little depth of flavor. But it has such a cool flavor because it's made from seaweed, kombu seaweed, and dried smoked bonito flakes. And it comes together in like 10 minutes. You simmer the seaweed for just a little bit, you let it steep, then you throw in the bonito flakes, you steep like a tea, and you pour it out, and it's done. It's not 4 hours on the stove. It's beautiful, it's savory, and it's great. All right, we have Lindsay on the line from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Hey, Lindsay, how are you?
Hi, I'm good.
What would you like to talk about today?
Well, I have a question about trying to use up lemon. I save all my scraps, the big bones and vegetable peels and all that kind of stuff, and I do vegetable stocks. I'm trying to reuse as much as I can. And
yeah, that's great.
It drives me crazy to throw away lemon after I've used the juice and the zest.
Oh. So you're basically left with like the membranes of the fruit and like the white pith.
Yeah, some pulp. It just seems like there's got to be something other than deodorizing the garbage disposal to do with them.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's be fair, like deodorizing a garbage disposal is a noble act, and that is a noble purpose for an already twice used lemon. So I guess I don't discount that entirely, but let's think. This is really interesting because I am totally 100% with you. Like, let's use everything we can. But a double spent lemon, I don't know if this will work, but I would certainly start by trying to flavor a syrup with it. And I think that's a good test.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah, I think that's a good test of how much flavor you can still get out of it. You know what I mean? Because if the yellow zest is gone, that's where a lot of the aromatic oil lives. So if that's gone, and obviously if the juice is gone, it's not super clear to me what's going to be left in the lemon that's going to have good flavor. But I would try with boiling a simple syrup, dropping the lemons in, you know, letting it simmer for a little bit, and come back to it maybe in, I don't know, 10 minutes and see if there's flavor that's leached out of lemons and infused the syrup.
Okay. I was thinking maybe vodka or something like that too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's definitely another way to do it. I mean, I think it's a little more inexpensive probably to just try with the syrup. But if you want to, you know, put a bottle of vodka on the sacrificial altar to the frugality gods, definitely try that. I mean, drop them into a bottle of vodka and, you know, come back after a day or two and see if there's a nice flavor there.
Okay.
Do you ever candy citrus?
I have occasionally. I like to make homemade cocktails, so sometimes I'll do grapefruit or lemon.
I mean, I might start with the syrup first because that'll give you a good sense of whether there's flavor to be had in there still, you know what I mean? And if you like that flavor, I would go ahead and candy them because, you know, when you candy a lemon, you usually do the whole thing, including all that white pith. Obviously, you would have the yellow zest in it as well, but you could see if there's good flavor in it and then just try candying just the white pith part and, you know, and the pulp as well.
That's a good idea. I hadn't thought of that.
Cool. Well, good luck and let me know what you find. I've never really thought about using those parts of the lemon. So let us know what happens.
All right. I will. Thank you for your help.
Cool. No, thanks for the call.
All right.
Take care.
Thanks, Randy.
And we'll be back with more of your calls and a story of art, power, and the dining room. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. All right, back to your questions. Give us a call, 1-800-537-5252, or find us on Facebook or Twitter or email. contact@splendidtable.org. All right, so we have Monica from North Carolina on the line. Hi, Monica.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I belong to a CSA here in my town, and I get a lot of cucumbers when they're in season, and I just don't know what to do with them. I usually let them rot in the refrigerator because I just don't know what to do. I put them in a salad, but that's about all I can think of. Pickles is not really my thing.
Do you ever cook cucumbers?
No, I never thought you could do that.
I'm so glad you called because cooking cucumbers is one of the great unsung things to do in like the entire American culinary canon. Like people never think about cooking cucumbers, but I grew up eating cucumbers and they're so delicious because they are sweet, but they still have that, you know, that fresh flavor from the cucumber. It takes some of that really kind of vegetal, green, grassy flavor out of it, and it just makes them tender and sweet, but you still have a really nice, clean freshness to them. So I would suggest a few things. A really simple way to do it. Do you like shrimp?
Yeah.
Great. So I think they're wonderful with shrimp. So I would suggest peeling the cucumber, cutting it into like half moons. If it has seeds, you know, scoop out the seeds and cut it into, I don't know, maybe like quarter inch thick half moons.
Mm-hmm.
And get a saute pan nice and hot. Get some oil in that pan, maybe a little bit of chopped ginger. Throw in your cucumbers, some salt, a little dash of sugar, not enough to really sweeten it, but just to balance the salt out, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And toss them around a few times, give a taste once in a while, and you don't want to cook it super, super soft where it's like almost mushy, just enough to get it so it's, you know, lost its crunch, lost its crispness, and it's just tender, but not mushy, you know what I mean? And that tossed with some nice seared shrimp, or you can even saute shrimp and then just combine the two, is a really, really fresh, beautiful combination for summer. I love that. And I would love to hear what you think of it.
Oh, okay.
And then if you want to take it a little bit further, I would try this. I would try giving them a really hard sear. So peel them if the skins are tough, if they're tender, you know, go ahead and keep them. Slice them in half. And this is ideally best for the kind of cucumber that doesn't have a lot of seeds, a lot of tough seeds in the middle where you just eat the whole thing. You don't have to scoop out the seeds.
Right.
Cut them in half lengthwise. Get your pan super hot this time.
Okay.
Put a little oil on the bottom and then lay the cucumbers in cut side down. And then don't touch them for a few minutes. Let them get really nice and seared, nice and dark. And then you can toss them a little bit in the pan just to kind of cook the other side a little bit. But really, you're just looking for that color. You're not really trying to cook the cucumber all the way through.
Okay.
Then you take it out and lay them on a plate. And from there, I would go some lemon juice, some herbs, maybe some basil, maybe some mint, like maybe some chopped toasted almonds, and a little bit of olive oil, and like kind of eat it like a salad.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so fresh and so delicious. You know, it has all those really good, fresh, summery flavors, but then you have that dark sear of the cucumber that just gives it a little bit of complexity, a little bit of like mysteriousness. And it's, and you know, people are like not used to eating cooked cucumbers, so it's already going to be unique.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So have fun with those. And if all else fails, really simple, do it Mexican style. Cut them up into pieces and lime juice, salt, and chili powder, all to taste. You want a little bit hot, a little bit sour, and a little bit salty, and it's just the most addictive snack. I can just eat bowl after bowl of it.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
Yeah, all right. Enjoy your CSA.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. We have Allison on the line from Floyd, Virginia. What would you like to talk about?
Well, about 8 years ago or so, this has been a burning question for me. I was watching the Spice Goddess on a cooking channel, and she was making this spiced city cake, and she added vinegar. And I had never seen anybody put vinegar in a cake before, aside from red velvet cake. And so it kind of sparked a question as to, first, why is there vinegar in a red velvet cake? Why did she put it in her spiced city cake? And if it's such a magical ingredient, why don't we include vinegar in all of our cakes?
Huh. Well, that's a good question. I'm guessing that there is baking soda in the cake rather than baking powder.
Okay.
And if that's the case, then the vinegar is there to activate the baking soda. So have you ever done this? Have you ever just like poured vinegar onto baking soda?
Yes.
It's like, I'm like, if you haven't done it, then like be prepared to relive your most fun, like second grade science class.
Because
it bubbles and it foams. But that's actually the action that rises your cake. Like that's the leavening. So when you have baking powder is basically baking soda with a powdered acid, and they don't combine when they're both dry. But when you add water to it, it'll combine with itself essentially and then produce those bubbles that will aerate the cake. And so that's why the cake rises, and that's why it's light and fluffy and beautiful.
Know,
my friend Stella Parks, who is a wonderful pastry chef, she's really, really phenomenal. She does a lot of research into like the history of American baking and the science of it. And she's really, really terrific. And she wrote a story a few years ago about like the history of red velvet cake. And it's totally fascinating. And there are so many things about it that like are contrary to what we think about red velvet cake. But the thing that's relevant here is old red velvet cake recipes, before there was what we call Dutch processed cocoa, when there was just natural cocoa, the natural cocoa naturally has a reddish tint. And those cakes, you would add vinegar in because vinegar or acids keep red things red. Like if you ever cooked like red cabbage and it starts to turn that like dusty pink color instead of that bright, that like deep purple.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you throw in vinegar while it's cooking, it'll actually stay deep purple rather than turn that dusty pink. So there's something about the whatever red pigments are in your food that react to acids, react to vinegars and or lemon juice, you know, other acidic things that like lock in that color. So those old red velvet cakes weren't the bright red we know now with like the food coloring. They were just reddish. But adding that vinegar kept that reddishness and didn't turn them brown when they baked.
Wow, that has been a question I have been wanting to know for years, and that finally makes some sense.
Well, I'm so glad to be able to be the messenger. Again, this was not my research. This was Stella Parks' research, but I'm glad that that little bit of trivia can live in your head now.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Cool. Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah, no, thank you for answering my question and taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure. Talk to you later. Take care. Always feel free to call us at 1-800-537-5252 or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So we've been talking about where we eat today, and it occurred to us that one place we don't seem to be doing a lot of eating anymore is the dining room. For a lot of people, it's a rec room or storage or really just where your nicest furniture gathers dust. But at their height, in Europe and America in the Victorian era, dining rooms were the power center of the home. One of the only spaces in your house that you allowed people to see, it's where you got to reveal what you wanted people to know about you. Your social status, your creativity, your wealth. It's where you made friends and allies, and sometimes enemies. Which brings us to the story of one of the most famous dining rooms ever, the Peacock Room. It's famous for its beauty and art, but also for its story of betrayal, obsession, and a feud that two men took to their deathbeds. Our managing producer, Sally Swift, has the story.
So when was the last time you actually ate in a dining room? And I mean a separate room, not a part of the kitchen, but a room that was designed specifically for a table and chairs for people to sit down and eat together. Where have dining rooms gone? I started to wonder about that after a visit to the Smithsonian, where I saw one of the most beautiful dining rooms I have ever been in. It's called the Peacock Room, and there is a crazy, interesting story about it that I'll tell you about in a minute. But first, I think we need to understand the historical significance of the dining room. Meet Dr. Lee Glaser. She's a curator of American art at the Freer Sackler Museum in Washington, D.C.
Well, the Victorian period was the apogee of the dining room. The dining room really comes into its own in the 19th century, and part of the reason for that has to do with the advent of consumer culture and the rise of the middle class, and along with that, an increasing division between public and private space. And so the dining room was a kind of private space that was also quasi-public. It was a space where you would invite people outside of your domestic circle in. And you know, certainly we see a lot of changes after the First World War. Not so many, you know, people who've watched Downton Abbey know this, that even rich people no longer have so many servants. But it's really after the Second World War, with the kind of complete democratization of consumer culture, the rise of convenience foods, different kinds of entertaining, the advent of television, all of these things really contribute to a much more informal lifestyle and where you're no longer embarrassed to see the spaces where food is being prepared.
Right. The interiors of the homes.
Exactly. And I would say that really probably up through the 1970s or 80s, most new construction still has like a set dining room and a set kitchen. But people don't know what to do with the dining room. They're not using it. Everyone's congregating in the kitchen. And so I think a lot of new construction now just has no division between those spaces. And the kitchen has sort of supplanted the dining room as the place where you show off your expertise and sophistication and so forth.
And your giant stove.
And your giant stove and your fancy food and all
no
of that.
No longer hidden.
Yeah.
What we consider a dining room today is a far cry from the magnificent room I am standing in with Lee Glaser. And the crazy story of this room, the Peacock Room, provides an object lesson in exactly what Lee was talking about when she was talking public versus private space. This is a room for eating, yes, but really it's a room about showing off. It's a jewel box. The walls are painted, you guessed it, peacock blue. The ceiling is covered in gold leaf. And there are peacock feather designs painted everywhere. It's like being inside a Fabergé egg. The dining room was built in a townhouse in London by a rich industrialist named Frederick Leyland, who wanted to show off his collection of Chinese porcelain. He hired this architect, Thomas Jekyll, to do the work. And one day, when the room was nearly done, Jekyll, the architect, turned to this guy who was working on some decoration in the front hall for some paint color advice. The guy was James McNeil Whistler. Yeah, that Whistler. Artist with a capital A. Does the painting Whistler's mother ring a bell? That guy. Well, no surprise, Whistler had some good ideas about paint color. And that is where the story turned. He took over in a seriously bossy pants way.
And everyone was pretty happy with that. Jekyll approved, Leyland approved. Whistler was pretty pleased with himself for coming up with this motif that was inspired by a peacock feather. This would have been in early summer of 1876, and the social season in London was over, and so the Leyland family went off to their country house, and they left Whistler alone and unsupervised in the room. And so that was when his imagination sort of took flight, and throughout the whole summer of 1876, he's writing the Leyland family these letters saying, I'm preparing a gorgeous surprise for you. You're never going to believe it. Everyone is going to be so jealous. And what he had proceeded to do was to cover literally every surface of the room with patterns inspired by the peacock plumage.
Whistler was telling Leyland not to come home because he wanted that room to be perfect. So when he finally feels like he's close enough to being done, he sends Leyland the all clear sign. And
Leyland was shocked when he came back to London. He couldn't believe the complete transformation of the room. He couldn't believe that Whistler was asking 2,000 guineas, a huge sum of money, for work that Leyland said he neither asked for nor desired. And then I think the straw that really broke the camel's back was that Leyland was this incredibly brooding, introverted guy, and Whistler had actually invited other artists and members of the press to watch him work in the room, because one of the problems with doing interior decoration is that it's in a private space, and how are people going to know that he's creating this masterpiece? And so Leyland felt that his privacy had been breached. He was absolutely furious with Whistler, and then Whistler became furious with Leyland.
This is now one hot mess. The room was still not finished. The prime wall space at the very end of the room was empty. And that was the site for Whistler's ultimate retaliation against Leyland's ingratitude.
So it was then that Whistler just went absolutely crazy. And so this space opposite the fireplace, it was empty because many years before, Leyland had commissioned and paid for a painting of women in white dresses. It was to be a fourth symphony in white by Whistler. Whistler had never finished it. And after he got mad at Leyland over the peacock room, he decided Leyland was never going to have that painting, which was to have been the perfection of art. And instead, he came back in the room and painted this mural of two fighting peacocks that he called Art and Money, or the Story of the Room. And they're two allegorical portraits of the artist on the left and the patron on the right. And if you look closely at the patron peacock, Leyland, you'll see that he's literally made of money. He's got breast feathers of gold and silver coins, and then the shillings that he shorted Whistler by paying in pounds rather than guineas are scattered in his feet. Mm-hmm. In platinum leaf, by the way. Platinum never tarnishes, so to ensure that they would always sort of pop and call attention to themselves.
Wow, and Whistler is quite beautifully represented in that painting as well.
He's quite beautifully represented, and he's also quite recognizable because he's given himself a platinum leaf crest feather. Whistler had this big head of dark curly hair, but a white forelock. It was kind of a family trait, and it was his trademark. Everyone in London knew him by his white forelock, and he sometimes would tie it up with a red ribbon to make it stand up. So people coming into this room for a dinner would have looked at this mural and immediately recognized who was represented. Leyland ultimately said to Whistler, if I ever see you even speaking to a member of my family again, I'll publicly horsewhip you. So by summer of 1877, they were completely estranged, and Whistler himself never saw the peacock room again. Now, Leyland, meanwhile, claiming he didn't like the room, must have recognized that he had a masterpiece because he never changed a thing, and he could have very easily hired somebody to come in and redo it all. So he would have been seated for the rest of his life. He died in 1892 at the head of his table looking at the unflattering portrait of himself as a parsimonious peacock.
It's a pretty amazing story.
Yeah.
Lee Glazer is curator of American art at the Smithsonian. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks so much for listening. And until next time, let me leave you with this from the singer Robert Earl Keane on Where He Eats. This old porch is just a steaming, greasy plate of enchiladas with lots of cheese and onions and a guacamole salad. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. And hey, I want to get one more plug in for our website, splendidtable.org. You'll find tons of recipes, and you can register for our monthly giveaway and sign up for our email newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. We tried real hard to make it self-explanatory, but I'll also explain that it's all about easy weeknight recipes. And we want to go where you're going. Take us along, subscribe to our podcast, and if you really like us, please leave us a review. Our show's produced by Jennifer Russell. Jennifer Lubke is our editor and technical director. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.